This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
11th, 2016, five climate activists shut down every pipeline carrying tar sands crude from Canada to the United States. One of them, Michael Foster, is in the state penitentiary in Bismarck, North Dakota. We will talk to the other four as they await their sentencing, and they will give the defense that so far no court has allowed them to tell a jury of their peers. Annette Klapstein looks like somebody's grandmother, a kind grandmother. In fact, Annette is part of the Seattle Raging Granny group. She's a mother of two and a retired attorney, and she's a valve turner. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Annette, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Good. Well, I'm glad to have you. I think you scare the oil industry. If a grandmother can be an activist, anybody can. What got you going down this path of climate activism?
Well, I have been an activist for social and environmental justice causes to some degree all of my life, since I was a teenager. I worked for the Puyallup tribe as staff attorney for 21 years, so I learned a lot from working with them, and I worked primarily on fisheries issues, so that was also, by necessity, environmental issues. And I read a lot and became aware that climate change was becoming an issue probably back in the 90s. I mean, it became an issue before that. I think I became aware of it in the early 90s. I think, like a lot of people, kind of waited for the politicians to deal with it, because surely even greedy, corrupt politicians could see that, you know, this would affect them and their children. And time went on and nobody did anything about it. Eventually, you know, I became very, very worried about what kind of future my children and all future generations are going to have, and started becoming very active around that issue. And specifically the Seattle Raging Grannies. Grannies are a group of older activist women, which there are groups across Canada and the entire United States. And we have what's called an unconvention every 2 years. And in 2012, we had an unconvention in Victoria, British Columbia, and it's a very loose-knit group with no hierarchy. People can do what they want as long as it's basically, you know, on the left, not the right. You know, we don't usually have resolutions, but at that particular unconvention, a resolution was introduced basically saying that climate change should be our top priority, that working for climate justice should be the granny's top priority, because that emergency, if it is not resolved, will foreclose action on all of the other issues that we care so much about. If we do not deal with the climate emergency, you know, we don't have a habitable planet for our grandchildren, and we have to deal with it. So the Seattle Grannies took that very seriously. We went back to Seattle and initially did a lot of lobbying. We wrote to every conceivable legislative representative at every level from city on up to national and asked for meetings. And we got meetings with some of them and asked them what they were going to do to address climate change. And it became very quickly apparent to us that, you know, we got a lot of nice talk, but no real action. So increasingly, I became aware that we were never going to get this political system to act. And I say that as somebody who worked as a lawyer for almost 30 years. We have some people would say it's broken. Some people would say it does what it's designed to do, which is to protect capitalism. It does nothing else. It does not work for the people it supposedly represents. You know, we are not going to get any action through that. So it's up to us. And that is the conclusion I came to. And I first did a direct action blocking an oil train outside of Anacortes. There are two refineries up in Anacortes, Washington. Then I brought the grannies into it, and the grannies were involved in a number of actions, including helping to shut down the port of Seattle during the Shell No campaign. We locked ourselves to our rocking chairs and blockaded one of the port entrances, and a number of other groups blocked all the other entrances, so we shut down the port for a day.
Were you at the Standing Rock protests by the Sioux tribe, and how does that connect to the valve-turning action?
I was not personally there, but I know a huge number of people from Seattle who were there. I would have liked to be there, but I just did not get the opportunity to go. However, that was going on at the same time as this particular action, the Valve Turner action, was being planned. And there was a call out from Standing Rock for there to be 4 days of prayer and solidarity with the resistance at Standing Rock, because that, you know, was very much the focal point of resistance to fossil fuel industry at that point.
What did you personally do to turn off a tar sands pipeline?
Well, for Emily and I, it was slightly different than for the others. All of us, you know, we had it coordinated that we were going to do it 15 minutes apart across four states. And we went with bolt cutters prepared to go inside and actually shut off the valves. But for us, we cut the chains that held the locks that opened the little doors into the enclosures. We went inside and, you know, we went to turn off the valves, but we had a person back in Seattle who called all of these pipeline companies 15 minutes before, you know, the scheduled shutoff. And then we had a support person on site who called 5 minutes before. And by the time we cut the bolts and got inside, almost immediately we could see that our particular pipeline was being shut off, because there was this thing that looked like a giant screw, which we could see manually going down and shutting it off. So we knew that it was being shut off remotely. So in our case, our goal of getting them to shut it down remotely actually worked.
As a former attorney, how would you describe the necessity defense?
The necessity defense is, it comes out of Old English common law, where the classic example is there is a burning building and there is a child inside, and you go to rescue the child and the door is locked. So you break the door down and rescue the child, and afterwards you're charged with burglary. And so the necessity defense is you plead, yes, technically I did do a crime. I did break the door down and break in. However, I did it to prevent the death of a child, which is a much higher good than burglary, you know, than worrying about burglary, than breaking a door. You do it to prevent a greater harm, and that's what the necessity defense is. And as I said many times when we've gone around to speak, in our case, the world is on fire and all the children are going to burn if we don't stop it.
Are you going to be allowed to present that to a judge?
Our judge in Minnesota did grant us the right to present the necessity defense. However, the prosecutor immediately appealed that. It was heard in the Minnesota Court of Appeals on oral argument this week on February 15th. And our lawyer says he is cautiously optimistic that they may dismiss the appeal, which would mean that we would indeed get to present the necessity defense, which would give us the ability to call in climate scientists and social scientists to talk about, you know, climate scientists to talk about how dire the emergency is that we are in and how quickly we need to turn it around, and social scientists to talk about how corrupt our system is and how it does not work for the good of the people.
Now, in North America or Europe or Australia, people can decide whether to do a climate action or not. You said that choice itself is a privilege. What did you mean by that?
Well, the people who are being most affected by climate change, you know, first and worst, are the people who've done the least to cause it. And they have no choice but to fight it. They have no choice but to fight these companies that are bringing in this death-dealing, you know, the pipelines that completely destroy their water, their air, their land. You look at the tar sands. That's why we pick the tar sands, because they're absolutely the worst of the worst on every level. They have absolutely devastated a huge area in Alberta, which is mostly Indigenous First Nations Cree people around there. And, you know, they have huge cancer rates. Their water is destroyed. Their land is destroyed. They've taken beautiful forests for miles and miles and miles and just absolutely removed them and turned it into a sea of toxic sludge for literally tens of miles all around. So people who are in that situation, where they are literally having their lives threatened in every conceivable way, have no choice but to stand up and fight it. I have a choice. I don't think I have a moral choice. You know, to be a moral human being in this time, I have to do everything I can, which is why I chose to do what I did. I will do what I have to do to stop it. And I also say that as an old white woman, I am in a better position to take the kind of risky action I took than, you know, most of my young people of color activist friends, because, frankly, the police may show up and shoot them. That happens all the time. That is unlikely to happen to me. I may go to jail, but I probably won't be killed for doing something like I did. And also, I have much less to lose. I am retired. I don't worry about having a job. My kids are grown. I don't have a family to support. And I have everything to gain for the young people in the world and those that will come after them, which is what I care about at this stage of my life.
Now, there's no legal remedy for what amounts to a developing mass murder by climate change. Do you think that someday pipeline and oil company executives might be tried for crimes against the planet, or will we have a truth and reconciliation process like South Africa did?
Well, you know, if there's any justice in the universe, they certainly would be tried for crimes against humanity. They've known since the 70s. You know, many documents have come out in just the last few years about Exxon and others. They've all known that they are causing climate change, and they've done everything in their power to obfuscate, to propagandize people to believe that it's not happening. It's now become so obvious. I think even people who said there was no climate change a few years ago are admitting, well, wow, look at Houston, look at Puerto Rico, look at the kind of hurricanes we're having. For us in the West, on the West Coast of the United States and British Columbia and Canada, what we saw this last year was a wildfire season completely unprecedented beyond anything we've ever seen. Yes, we always have wildfires, but for the first time ever, and I'm 65, I'll be 66 in June, we had weather forecasts in Seattle that were day after day smoke. That was the weather forecast, smoke. The wildfires in the mountains and all up and down the coast and inland were so bad that we had ash dropping out of the sky day after day. We had to wear masks. That's what we're facing, and it's only going to get worse. We've already got about 40 years of climate change baked into the system. There's a 40-year delay on a lot of it. It stays up there, plus what we've been adding in the meantime. So we're too late for a good outcome, but we're not too late to choose between a bad outcome and an apocalyptic outcome. And that's what we're fighting for at this point, is to save as much as we can for future generations.
When will your case be tried, Annette, and how can people support you and the other valve turners?
We don't yet know when our case will be tried. We've been told that the Court of Appeals will make their decision by May, sometime in May. And it could be sooner, but it's likely to be May. After that, assuming that they rule in our favor, well, either way, I guess, it will go back to the trial court, and they will set a date for trial. So we are assuming our trial will be sometime this summer. That's the likeliest, but we don't have a date yet. And, you know, we just had Michael Foster get sentenced to 3 years in prison in North Dakota. Two were suspended, but he is in prison right now in North Dakota. So we have a lot of legal expenses, and one of the things people can do is contribute to our legal defense fund. We really appreciate that. If you go to either our website, shutitdown.today, or our Facebook page, which is called Climate Direct Action, it's shutitdown-climatedirectaction. Either one will direct you to our legal defense fund, and we really need people to contribute. Beyond that, we would love to have people come out to our trial. You know, any of us who get jail time would probably welcome visitors if people happen to be in those areas. We don't want people to commute long distances to visit us, but people who might be in the states we'd be serving time in, we'd love to have visitors. And we hope that people will go out and get active. That is the most important thing. This is a, you know, the emergency of not only our lifetime, but really of humanity's lifetime. If we don't turn this around, we are in a world of hurt, and people need to look beyond their comfort and convenience and do everything in their power to put a stop to what the fossil fuel industry is doing to our planet. They really are. They're the real criminals. We don't see ourselves as criminals, but we certainly see them as criminals.
From Washington State, we've been talking with valve turner Annette Klapstein. As she says, find out more at the website shutitdown.today. Thank you so much for talking with us, Annette.
Thank you.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.